go ahead and turn in your Old Testaments to the book of Nehemiah. We'll start in Nehemiah just a little bit. While you're turning there, let me just make a plug for the youth lectures that are coming up in less than a week on Saturday, July 23rd. We're going to be spending our time talking about the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5 through 7. I'm really excited about it. The more I get into it, the more I study for it, the more eager I am for that day to arrive. So I really encourage everybody to be there if you have an opening in your Saturday. We say this every year, and I want to say it again. This is a lectureship that is specifically geared for younger people. And so we especially want our younger people there. But if you're an older person as well, or middle-aged, or whatever bracket you consider yourself in, these lessons are going to apply to you too. So I really encourage us all to be a part of that on that day, and encourage anybody else that we know of to be there as well. So what we're going to do today is continuing our theme that we're studying this year, from a passage in John where Jesus is talking with his own disciples, and he is trying to push their attitudes and their viewpoint away from "we're just going to focus on Jews around us" to broadening the field to the Samaritans that he is in that passage when he says, "Look up, guys, the fields are white for harvest." They're in a Samaritan village. And then eventually he's going to broaden their horizon to the four corners of the earth so that every single human being in the world, no matter what generation we're living in, has the opportunity to come to Jesus. That's the message of the gospel. Amen. That Jesus gave. And so what we're going to do today is go to Nehemiah and talk about one of the roles of evangelism. This year we've been saying over and over, you know, regardless of who you are, if you are a teacher, that's great. We need Pauls. But if you are not a teacher, if you're not somebody who's going to stand up here or who's going to lead a Bible study around a kitchen table, there is still a place for you in the work of bringing lost souls to Jesus. Everybody can have a part to play in that. And so we need people who are brainstormers. And I want to spend the rest of this sermon kind of unpacking what I mean by that. And if you're looking at the little picture on the front of your bulletin, you will notice that this is a little bit out of order according to the schedule that I mapped out. But I'm bumping it forward for reasons that I'm not going to explain here. But today we're going to do this. We're going to do this one, and then we're going to look at Phoebe next month, and then we're going to end with Joash the month after that when we talk about exhorter. So let's talk about Nehemiah. Let's talk about habits. Habits are difficult things to form, and habits are also difficult things to break, aren't they? Because it takes energy and thought in order to change the kind of person that we are. We are creatures, it's often said, it's cliche, but it is true, we are creatures of habits. So we just kind of find our groove, and we tend to stay in our groove, regardless of whether that groove is good for us or not. And so a lot of people, just in the way that they live their lives, they think the way things are, that's just the way things are going to be. But it's interesting that throughout Bible history, and Nehemiah is one of these big examples, there are godly people who come along and say, "Okay, the way things are not the way things should be, and let's lead a trail, let's blaze a trail and lead ourselves that way." You think about guys like Hezekiah, king of Judah. You think about another king of Judah named Josiah, who came a little bit later on. You know, people are getting into ruts of idolatry, and they stand up and say, "No, God's that way. Let's go to God, and let's lead ourselves toward Him." Well, Nehemiah is one of those type of guys. He is a man who thought very carefully about plans that the people would be wise to follow, and then he prayed like crazy about those plans and about his efforts to lead God. So it wasn't just him kind of going off into a corner and just making these decisions himself. He is planning, but he is also praying
to God. And we need people in our evangelistic work who can do that, who can help us look at what we're trying to do and help us tweak that and go to God for that, for those plans to succeed. Do you remember in Acts chapter 6 when there's a problem in the Jerusalem church? You got the widows who are Hellenistic, who are Greek-speaking widows, and they're getting overlooked. Remember what the apostles say about their role for that? They say, you know, we're not going to wait tables. We're going to let you guys decide who's going to help those widows. We're going to devote ourselves to the ministry of the word and to prayer. So you see that happening with Nehemiah in a really neat way. And I want to look at this text with you today about how we can become more like him. But first, what I want to do is remind ourselves of what Nehemiah stepped into for a second, so we can just get the context for a little bit. When you open the book of Nehemiah, it's a very difficult time for God's people in their history, because the walls had been destroyed for about, roughly speaking, 140 years. Because in 586 BC, the king of Babylonia got really tired of these little rebellions that kept forming in Judea. Once in a while, one of the kings that he had kind of had his finger on would try to throw off the yoke. And so finally, he comes to the city for the last time with his entire army and just destroys everything. He gets Solomon's temple razed to the ground. He takes the walls around the city. He beats them down until they're nothing, just but piles of rubble. He kills a lot of the people. He takes the king, King Zedekiah. He puts out his eyes right after he kills Zedekiah's sons right in front of his eyes. So that's the last thing Zedekiah sees. He takes the high priest, you know, who is one of the most honored people in the land. He slaughters him and takes all these people of Judea back to his country in Babylonia. So Jerusalem is robbed of its leaders, it's robbed of its temple, and it's robbed of its walls. And that's a really vulnerable place to be in, because if you don't have walls in the ancient city, I mean, anybody can do whatever they want with you. You have no protection whatsoever. When by the time Nehemiah comes in about 445 BC, Jews had started to come back to the land, because eventually after Babylon, the Persians take over, and the Persians they have a different foreign policy than the Babylonians do, and they say, hey guys, we want to make you happy, we want you to be great citizens for Persia, so guess what, you get to go back home. And you get to rebuild your temples to your gods. And so Israel said, woohoo, that means us too. And so God allowed different waves of Jews to come back into the land. And at first it went really well. They laid a foundation for the temple. But then the local people of the land got really antsy about that. And they said, whoa, we do not want Israel to rise again. We want to push them down and keep them there. And so the enemy stopped them for a long time. They finally got the temple rebuilt. So when Nehemiah comes, the temple had been rebuilt, had been there for about 70 years. After prophets like Haggai and Zechariah stood up and said, okay guys, stop building your fancy paneled houses and get up there on the hill and actually serve God and build the house that he wants you to build. But the walls were not rebuilt, at least not very well at all. And so that by the time Nehemiah comes, there is just this long-standing culture of inertia, of this idea of the way things are not great, and everybody knows they're not great, but it's just the way things are going to be for the foreseeable future. Because generation after generation comes and goes, and everything stays the same. It's interesting when you notice, just look at the Nehemiah chapter 1, very first chapter. Notice what it says there, almost the opening verse. So it gives us, you know, Nehemiah says, hey, hello, I'm writing this. Verse 1, this is when it happens. Verse 2, Hananiah, one of my brothers, came with certain men from Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews who escaped, who survived, concerning Jerusalem, and they said to me, well,
you know, there's a lot of things to talk about. You know, the market's a really great place, and the governor's living in a nice house, and there are all these things to talk about. Now, look at what they emphasize. The remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. Why? Well, he explains, they don't have a wall. They haven't had a wall since the Babylonian time. It's broken down. Its gates are destroyed by fire. Nobody was doing anything about this, despite the fact that it was there for everybody to see. Even the visitors who were coming in and leaving Jerusalem could point the finger and say, "Whoa! This is a pretty glaring issue that we are not addressing like we should." But it still remains the same. You know, I think there's an application here. I think this is where all of us need to step into the shoes of these people and think about our own lives. Are there walls in your life or my life or in the lives of our families that are broken down and have been broken down for a very long time, and we just sort of gotten used to stepping over the rubble and doing other things? That's their situation here. Because it's really easy to point fingers elsewhere. It's easy to say, okay, I'm seeing problems with this brother. I'm seeing problems with the church family that I'm a part of. Okay, well, maybe you're right about those things. But what are you doing about the culture that you would like to change in yourself, in your family, and in the church? Are you living out the kind of life that you wish to see in other people? Well, my brother needs to get better about that. Okay, well, what are you doing about that? What are you doing about that? So that you can set a good example, so that you can change. If you see inertia in other people, what about in you? Are you changing that in your own life? So that's not what's happening when Nehemiah gets there. But it would happen pretty quickly after he moves to Judea. Look at chapter 2. Look at what he does. Even before he goes to Persia, to plan out what is going to happen. Chapter 2, we're introduced to him as a cupbearer in the first verse of chapter 2. Talk about when that happens, where he goes to the king. But notice what happens here as he thinks through the initial preparations. Chapter 2, verse 5, I said to the king, after the king noticed that he was a little bit sad, and he said, I have been sad in the presence of the king. So the king kind of asks about that, and he talks about the situation, and the king says, what are you requesting? The verse 5, I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it. And the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, how long will you be gone? And when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time. And I said to the king, if it pleased the king, let letters be given me to the governors of the province beyond the river, that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple and for the walls of the city and for the house that I shall occupy. And the king granted me what I asked, for the good hand of my God was upon me. I think it's so neat that by the time Artaxerxes kind of unexpectedly opens the door for a conversation, Nehemiah was already prepared with what he was going to ask for. He said, I already knew what the timeline was going to look like. Because the king said, how long are you going to leave this post of cupbearer empty? Well, he had an answer for that. He also said, I need letters. And I know who I need letters to. I need a letter for this guy so that I can pass, so that I can get a visa. You know, so I can travel the way I want to travel. And I also need a letter to the guy in charge of construction materials, so that I can actually go there and build the thing that I want to build. That's really impressive to me. And so not only did he think through the initial prep work, notice what happens when he gets there. So let's keep reading in chapter 2. Verse 11, Nehemiah 2, I went to Jerusalem, I was there 3 days, and I rose in the night, and I and a few men with me, and I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. There was no animal with me but the one only on which I rode. I went out by night by the valley gate to the dragon spring, to the dung gate. I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that were broken down and its gates that had been destroyed by fire. It's the same phrase in chapter 1, by the way. And I went on to the fountain gate, to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. Then I went up by night by the valley and inspected the wall, and I turned back and entered by the valley gate and so returned. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, and I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were to do the work. You know, when a governor comes to a town, what would you expect him to do? You would expect him to go to the Ritz, or what was nearest to the Ritz, and just kind of park himself in a nice cushy place and wait for his servants to go out and do the things that they need to do for the work. But Nehemiah doesn't relax. He hits the ground running when he gets to Jerusalem. And not only that, he inspects the walls personally himself. He doesn't send anybody else out to do that. In fact, he explicitly says there in verse 16, nobody even understood why he was there. He didn't even tell the bigwigs in town why he had come to Jerusalem until he had gone out himself and inspected all this. And notice the kinds of places that he mentions here. These phrases like Valley Gate and Dung Gate. Sounds like a great place to be, right? Dragon Spring. These are names that don't mean a lot to us, but this is talking about the whole southern and eastern side of the walls of Jerusalem. He went all over there, and he didn't just glance around. He's riding all over, and he's getting so close to it that it says here, I tried to go into places where my animal couldn't even get into. So he's not just, yeah, there it is. He is personally getting up close to it as much as he possibly can. That is really neat. So in verse 17, when he gathers everybody together and he says, you see the trouble we're in, he's speaking not just about their experience, he's speaking about his personal experience too, because he went out and he saw this before he gets everybody together and sounds the charge on that. So he is a, notice the meticulous planning that we see here. Something else you notice when you get to chapter 4 is after they start construction work, he has to make adjustments to keep the progress going the way that it should go. Look over here in chapter 4 of Nehemiah. Chapter 4 of Nehemiah in verse 13. So in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, in open spaces, I stationed the people by their clans with their swords, spears, and bows. I looked and arose and said to the nobles and the officials, the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them, the enemies that are trying to kill them right now. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes. Y'all, it's not just movies like Braveheart where you see stirring battle scenes like this. I mean, that's in the Bible long before Mel Gibson took up his sword, right? This is awesome literature. When our enemies heard that it was known to us and that our God had frustrated their plan, we all returned to the wall, each to his work. From that day, half of my servants worked on construction, and half held the spears and the shields and the bows and the coats of mail. And the leaders stood by in the whole house of Judah who were building on the wall. Those who carried burdens were loaded in such a way that each labored on the work with one hand and held his weapon with the other, and each of the builders had his sword strapped at his side while he built. The man who sounded the trumpet was beside me, and I said to the nobles and the officials and to the rest of the people, the work is great and widely spread. We're separated on the wall, far from one another. In the place where you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. So we labored at the work, and half of them held the spears from the break of dawn until the stars came out. And I also said to the people at that time, let every man and his servant pass the night within Jerusalem, that they may guard for us by night, that we may labor by day. So neither I nor my brothers nor my servants nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us took off our clothes. Each held his weapon at his right hand. So about the time when everything is starting to get off the ground, there are serious reasons that a lot of people see to stop the construction, because there's enemies like Sanballat and Tobiah the Ammonites and Geshur, and they're all trying to plot the destruction of the workers. And you have fellow Jews, we're told earlier in the chapter, who came and said, "Guys, this is just too hard. We can't do this. So you better get away from Jerusalem, because there's too much rubble, and you got a lot of enemies who are breathing down your necks. So just get out of there. Stop doing this." But in spite of all of that noise, what does Nehemiah do? He says, "Okay, here's what we're going to do. We're all going to keep hold of our construction materials and our tools, but we're also going to keep hold of our swords. And we're going to put people in the gaps, and we're going to get a trumpet guy to sound the alarm, and we're all going to make a plan. When you hear that trumpet, you go to that spot, and our God is going to fight for us." So he makes plans, and then he tweets them. So you see a guy who just never turns off his mind or his spirit. Nehemiah is always planning, and he's always going to be praying, as we're going to see here. So he always keeps his vision of rebuilding the wall, and he's always evaluating the best way in which to accomplish that goal. I'll tell you what, folks, and this is where it hits us. In our efforts to build God's kingdom in this area, we need people like Nehemiah who can help us as a group evaluate what we're doing and tweak it where we need to tweak it so that we can be more effective and efficient. We need people who are not afraid to vocalize those things. Maybe not in front of the entire group, but maybe pulling aside people around you, and not in a gossiping way, and not in a "let me tell you about the complaints that I have about Teensboro" kind of way, but in a way that says, "Hey, let's encourage us to go in this direction. Let's tweak this thing that we need to tweak." Yeah, I think it's interesting when I think about the makeup of our group. We have a lot of builders here. A lot of builders. We have scientists, we have mechanics, we have nurses, we have educators, we have artists. We have people who are used to taking problems and working through those problems and taking them into a next level to create beauty out of something that was not so beautiful. I think many of you are used to doing this kind of work in your secular jobs, in your lives. And even if you didn't find yourself on the exact list of occupations that I just listed off, I have no doubt that in the life you have, in your home, in your family, and in this church, you are a creator in some kind of way. God has blessed humans with that gift to build, to construct, to create. So let me just encourage you, in whatever way that gift manifests itself in your life, let me encourage you to harness that creativity and that power, not just for the dollars and cents in your bank account, not just for your secular life, but for the cause of the kingdom of God. If you see things that we can do internally or with regard to our work for other people that can be changed, please don't be afraid to tell me about that, to tell the elders about that. And by the way, the questionnaire that has kind of been forgotten about at this point that we gave you guys at the beginning of the year, that's part of the purpose of that. So we can open the door wide and say, you know, we're interested in being ears and in listening to your thoughts about the work of this group so that we can become better in the cause of the Lord. So we need Nehemiahs to help us think about how to navigate these situations. And we need people who pray like Nehemiah, who not just plan, but get on their knees before our gods. Notice this. Go back to chapter 1. Notice what happens when he first finds out about the walls. Chapter 1, verse 4. "As soon as I heard these words about what his brother said about the way of Jerusalem is broken down and all that, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven And I said, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God, who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love Him and keep His commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you day and night for the people of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the people of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Even I and my father's house have sinned. We've acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, the rules that you commanded your servant Moses. Remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me, keep my commandments and do them, though your outcasts are in the uttermost parts of heaven, from there I will gather them and bring them to the place that I have chosen to make my name dwell there. They are your servants and your people, whom you have redeemed by your great power, by your strong hand. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant, and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name, and give success to your servant today, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. We find out this man was, in the very next phrase, oh, I was, by the way, cupbearer to the king of Persia. Which is pretty intimidating, as he kind of says a little bit later on. So you notice what he does. He immediately goes into a prayer mode. He mourns, he fasts, but he doesn't just feel sorry about this. He does something about it, and the best possible thing to do is approach the God who allowed Nebuchadnezzar to come against the walls in the first place because of sin. And that's what he talks about in his prayer, is we have all sinned. Which is interesting because was Nehemiah a part of the destruction? Was he a part of that generation? He had never lived in Judea in his life, and yet he still takes responsibility for the sins of his fathers and says, we have all, myself included, been responsible for what happened to our nation. That's an amazing statement. There's a lot more that we could say about that. But notice else what he's doing here. He is calling upon God to fulfill his promises, isn't he? He said, I've read the Old Testament. The Old Testament that he had up to this point. And he said, I know what you told Moses. You said that even if destruction comes on us, you're going to be there. And you're going to gather the people that you have scattered to the winds. I want you to do that for us, because we're in that boat right now in our lives. But we need people who pray this kind of stuff to God on behalf of us, our congregation. Not, please God, just fix all these other people. Please God, no, but rather, please God, help us to rise up and build the things that we need to build. I think it's interesting in chapter 2, verse 4, this is a very short prayer that we have in this verse, when the king asks him, hey, I'm noticing that, you know, you just kind of dried your eyes a little bit, you got a sad face. What's going on with you? Are you sick? Something happening? Verse 4, then the king said, you know, what are you requesting? After Nehemiah started to explain. And notice what it says, so I prayed to the God of heaven. And I'm sure that prayer was probably nothing more than, oh God, please help. Because he's in the middle of a conversation. He doesn't have time to give the kind of prayer that he gave there in chapter 1. But he's still doing it. You know, because God is constantly on his mind, and communication with him is a constant priority. So he's going to do that no matter what kind of situation he's in, including when he's faced with enemies. And boy, did he have enemies. And this is kind of chapter 4. Here, if you look there, it's kind of representative of that. Notice this prayer that he prays here. It's interesting. As most of Nehemiah is a story, is a narrative. But occasionally, we get this stop of the story in order for Nehemiah to record prayers that he prayed when those things were happening at the time. And so, at the beginning of chapter 4, you've got enemies coming and just jeering at the Jews and trying to cause problems. And so verse 4 says, hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunt on their own heads. Give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captives. Do not cover their guilt. Let their sin not be blotted from your sight. For they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders. And in chapter 6, verse 14 is kind of similar to that. And so what Nehemiah does is he does what he can to resist these people. He tries to make plans. He tries to keep the progress moving forward. But he recognizes that it's not my job to figure all this out, ultimately. It's the job of God to fight for us, like he says to the builders. And so when you get faced with opposition to the work of Jesus, you get people who are looking down their nose at you because of what you do for Jesus in his cause. You know, take that frustration and channel it to the right place, like Nehemiah did. And then something else that's interesting, and I'll just look at one example of this. I've got the other scriptures on the board if you want to look at those on your own time. But in chapter 5, notice verse 19. Notice chapter 5 in verse 19. What Nehemiah also prays about is about the work that he did. You know, I think anybody who builds anything is going to wonder about whether it's going to last. You know, if you're a king and you're having sons, you're wondering, is my dynasty going to last? You know, or is it going to just kind of fizzle out and somebody else takes over the throne? If you construct a beautiful table and chairs, you're going to be wondering, is this going to last past my lifetime and be used far beyond me? Now, that happens with Nehemiah. He's trying to rebuild walls. He's trying to help these people physically and spiritually. And I think it's interesting, notice what he says here in verse 19 after it says, this is the way that I operated as a governor. I didn't fleece people. I was generous as I could be. All of this stuff happened. Remember, oh, for my God, for my good, oh my God, all that I have done for this people. And we find out later in the book that, you know, he goes back home and then he comes back and there's all these problems. You know, the men have intermarried with the foreign women of the land, and they're having kids, and half of those kids can't even speak Hebrew. They're speaking the Philistine language of Ashdod, and so all kinds of issues arise. And so at the end, in fact, the end phrase of the book there in chapter 13 is, remember me for my good. Okay? You know, I did the best that I could. But I'm praying to you about this and just putting it in your hands, and you can do with this whatever you want to do with it. We need Nehemiahs who are leaning on the Lord as hard as this. You know, becoming better at teaching the lost is not all about honing our techniques, honing our craft, making sure that we say things in the best possible way. Certainly that's a part of it, but the vast majority of this work belongs to our God. You know, we can plant and we can water, but He is the one that causes the increase and the growth from anything good that we try to do. I think it's interesting that over and over in the book of Nehemiah, but also in the book of Ezra is a guy who is working alongside of Nehemiah often, you see this phrase happening over and over, the good hand of my God was upon me, and that's why the king gave me what I wanted, and that's why we built the wall in 52 days, and that's why enemies didn't completely thwart our work. So we need Nehemiahs who have that kind of fervency to pray for us like this. Kurt and I have been going through the book of Ezekiel. In fact, we're almost done with it. But I was just so struck when we got to chapter 36 together and we read this passage, how much this resonated with the kind of thoughts that we're trying to think this year. Listen to this. This is an Old Testament prophecy. But you notice what Ezekiel is told. Thus says the Lord God, this also I will let, I will allow the house of Israel to ask me to do for them, to increase their people like a flock for sacrifices, like the flock at Jerusalem during her appointed feast. So shall the waste cities be filled with flocks of people, and then they will know that I am the Lord. Which, by the way, is just a phrase that you see practically in every chapter in Ezekiel, and definitely here, because
It's God who increases his family, not us, ultimately. That's his job to do. And we need to ask him to do it, which really fits with what Jesus says. Remember in Luke 10, we've mentioned this already in these sermons, where he says the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few, so God's gonna wait to hear from us about that. Therefore, pray earnestly. Earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers, typo, to his harvest. But we need to be doing that. Because when you think about Jesus and what he did, he relied on his Father to bring change to God's people. Is that our attitude? Do we have Nehemiahs who have this idea in mind? You know, when Jesus came here, there was a status quo, wasn't there? The Pharisees were entrenched and doing their thing. Sadducees were up there at the temple doing their thing with the Romans. You had King Herod on the throne. He was pretty happy doing his thing. You had the Romans in charge. But there was nobody who had the solution to sin. Nobody. And you had Jews who thought, well, the answer is we got to get a Messiah to get rid of the Herod that's ruling over us and the Romans that are backing him up. And then our problems will be solved. Political change is not the solution to spiritual growth. They missed that boat in the first century. If we're not careful as Christians, we will fall into the same trap of thinking political change should be our focus. That is not the focus of God's people. Jesus came to lead a spiritual revolution to change hearts and minds, not the person sitting on the throne. Eventually that would happen, but Jesus had bigger fish to fry than Herod and his minions and Caesar on his throne. And what he did was, he constantly leaned on his Father in order to change those hearts and minds. I think it's interesting, in Luke chapter 6, in 12 and 13, we're told what Jesus did right before he picks his apostles. It says, in these days, Luke 6, 12 and 13, he went out to the mountain to pray. He went out to pray. And all night he continued in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples and chose from them 12, whom he named apostles. And right before the cross, remember in John 17, he prays this beautiful prayer that God would protect his guys and lead them and comfort them so that they can do the kind of work that they need to do. Nehemiah was just a shadow of what the true king, the true builder would be like. By the way, what was Jesus' physical trade? He was a carpenter, which in those days just didn't mean he worked with wood. He also worked with stone and other building things. Jesus was a builder by profession in his family. That's what Joseph did. But even greater, Jesus was a builder of his church. You know, you can go to Jerusalem today, and I've been to Jerusalem, and there is no sign of Nehemiah's wall. You just can't. I don't think we have any areas, and I could be wrong, but I don't think there's any area of the city where they can just look and say, there's Nehemiah's wall. There it is. It's still standing. It's crumbled. The work that he did all those thousands of years ago, you can't see it today. But you know what you can see? Because of what Jesus has built. Anywhere you go on the globe, you can see people's lives being changed and rebuilt from the ground up, from the ashes, because Jesus' church has never fallen and it never will. The gates of Hades are not going to prevail against it, just like he said. We've got to be a part of that ourselves. Because it's going to be there for us to be a part of, always. And then we need to do our best to help other people to be a part of that too. But what we're going to be doing today in the Lord's Supper is remembering the whole reason why we can celebrate this, why it's still standing, why it exists, why we're a part of it, is because of what Jesus did
to give up his life in order for us to be built up. He was torn down. You know, remember what he said? Destroy this temple, but in 3 days, arise again. They had no idea what he meant by that. But with an eye back to the cross, we can see what he accomplished. And we can celebrate that together, his body and his blood that were given for us, for our sins, and for the sins of every generation of mankind, so that we can be saved and taken to God when all this is over. Are we Nehemiahs? Is the question of this lesson. But also, I think in a greater way, the question is, are we Jesus's? Let's partake together.